And I was just thinking about it last time in terms of women presidents and what sets them apart, you know, as we like to, you know, to think, you know, it's great that they're been able to, you know, people voted for them. They are at the, you know, they've worked hard to get where they got to. But these are just a few. Again, we're talking about women presidents, ministers. You have ministers, you know, over in, as well as parliamentarians. Are they enough? In my opinion, no. But at the same time, women, girl, and, you know, education is very important. And I think there is still a lot more to be done. And it's also about changing people's mindset. You know, at the end of the day, you know, even if you have somebody at the head of a country being a woman, that doesn't change the fact that the person who lives, you know, in region X, et cetera, still, you know, views her as the president, yes, but it doesn't change the way they act with the rest of the women in their, you know, localities, et cetera, et cetera. So they need to be, I think, you know, not only engaging the women, but the men as well, because as we said, you know, not just because I'm a woman parliamentarian, am I going to take women issues. You know, I would like also to talk about other things as well. So we definitely don't, we cannot also silo, you know, and just say because they are women parliamentarians, they are necessarily going to take up these different issues. You know, but we need to, I think, you know, broaden the frame and educate all of the male, the men parliamentarians and the women parliamentarians. I definitely agree with having a quota system in a way if, for countries where they don't, you know, having parties also make sure that they have women within their ranks and that those women are being heard. Because as we just said, just having, you know, a quota and just having them there or having them in your party and just using them to rally other women to come, you know, and not listening to what they have to say is not productive as well. So I think, you know, we definitely need to do more in terms of making sure that women's issues are taken, you know, into consideration, you know, at the table, and also that, you know, we encourage them to be, you know, more empowered and also go to school as well as men, you know, and boys as well. But, you know, creating an environment where everybody's ideas are valued and knowing that, you know, just because I'm a woman, that doesn't mean that I cannot do it or, you know, that I'm only ascribed to chores at home. You know, I'm a thinking being and I'm able to still participate.
I mean, it's sad because it's something that came with seeing women as inferior, something that came with during colonial time that remained during post-colonial times. In pre-colonial times, the African woman was not completely, was not even completely, wasn't considered inferior, and she was not. They were not considered inferior.
Yeah.
Just do one or two more questions and get to the audience.
I just want to say that, I mean, it's great that now, for example, even Thomas Sankara in the 1980s took on this project of empowering women. He even instituted there was one day per week that men would go to the market to see how it is, the reality. And actually, it's very helpful, even in my own family. There are huge discussions between my parents about the price of the food is rising, but no, it's not rising, et cetera, et cetera. So it's great to see after 25 years that this is coming back to the table.
You had leaders like Amilcar Cabral and Secretary mentioned these things as well. So these are not like old ideas at all, but they just haven't like been manifest. But I think that one good thing that for personally I see with a woman like increasing, like I agree with you guys, it's not where it needs to be, but it's changing, is that I think women are completely changing the way we look at politics. Also, those participating, because I want to use the example of Samia Nkrumah right now, who's the daughter of Kwame Nkrumah and is a parliamentarian. And whenever there is an interview, whenever she talks with people of the press, she talks about things like, you know, healthcare. It talks about, like, you know, women's issues, other things that the men usually don't bring up. And it's just kind of changing the atmosphere, because usually with these political parties, it's all about, like, who's going to bring you water and give you more money. But it's, like, talking about these fundamental issues has to make them change the way they see politics or deal with politics on the continent. So I think it's a very, very good thing to get a completely different perspective.
I don't want to over-romanticize women, though. Like, yeah. They're going to bring good things. They're going to bring health care. Like, no.
So one or two more quick questions, and this first one is related to this topic of women, and this is to think about the relationship between population growth and development. In North Africa, 50% of the women use contraception, and only 10% of them report an unmet need for contraception. In other words, virtually everyone who wants access to contraception in North Africa has access to contraception among women. In West Africa, only 14% of the women use contraception, and 28% say they want it and they can't get it. Tell me about this. And I've talked to a demographer to ask her to explain what the difference is in North Africa, and she said it's the government investment in education and government investment in access. But there's also a micro-level question, which is a personal one and a generational one. So tell me about that a little bit. How big do you want your family to be? And when are you going to be ready to have a family? And this is a sociological question.
Okay, well, I mean, how big do I want my family to be?
How big does your father want your family to be?
Oh, that's my question.
I grew up in a big family. I grew up in a big family. And I thought it was really nice. So, although I have a lot of goals that I set myself, I still want a big family just because I like the atmosphere in a big family. So I don't know, maybe four kids. My parents, they don't really, my mom, she tells me every time, don't forget to have babies. She was like, it's great what you're doing and everything, but don't forget to have at least one baby. So, I mean, I don't exactly know why there is this difference in Northern Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, especially. I'm a bit puzzled in all this. Maybe you guys are gonna explain to me. But also, it's a religion in Northern Africa is very important. So I would just assume that they would not be that liberal about contraception either, because
a surprise.
Yes, yeah, it's a real surprise.
I think I listen, you know, it's like there's been, you know, family planning is out there, right? So such good things, you know, family planning, health, you know, making sure that, you know, women are aware of their options and being able to seek help when they need to. I mean, as you said, I don't know if the governments are definitely, you know, and ministries are definitely pushing this, or if it's their number one priority. I think, you know, every country or is aware definitely of population growth now. You know, in our societies, we like larger families, you know, and that, you know, but again, it changes as, you know, if you're educated or if you're not, you know, I don't want to generalize, but, you know, saying that if women go to school, then they are able to have, you know, make their decisions and have less children. That's what's being said. And I don't know what the difference is, of course, you know, between that, because I thought we were doing okay. However, you know, somebody who lives, you know, in the village and then doesn't have those options is different from somebody who's in the urban cities, you know, may or may not have those options still. In cities as well, you have, you know, different differences. As you know, I grew up in a, just to give it, my dad is, you know, and my grandfather had one wife, was born in a family of 11. Now, I love the family. I have plenty of cousins. Will I have 11 children? No. Do I want 5 children? Maybe, because I'm one of 5. And I have cousins that are one of, so, but I think I have, you know, choices, you know, and I can make those decisions. Now, it's different from somebody else who is like, you know, they don't have access to family planning, and they don't know how, you know, because to tell you the truth, you know, when you go to school, when I went to school, we did biology, but we didn't delve into what is what and what is not what. So there is still, you know, I think, and again, I'm talking about when I went to school. It may have changed now. But there was still that thing where you didn't talk about it, you know, about what the options were and things. So I think there definitely needs to be more awareness raising in terms of as I said, you know, family planning that is there, but that's not accessible to everybody.
All right, last question.
Unless
one of the guys is very quiet.
I think it's kind of unfortunate there's not really any statistics from 100 years ago to compare African family sizes to now. Because when we say that, we have five kids in our family or something like that, it seems that's normal. Because we understand our parents and our grandparents who have 11, 15 brothers and sisters. So coming down to five from 11 or 15 is quite a huge jump. But still five is seen as quite big these days. So it'll be interesting to see, how that.
It will. The Ethiopian novelist Binah Mengistu just won the Genius Award from the MacArthur Foundation, and the National Book Foundation had previously named him a 5 under 35. So that was good news because it means you're still a young person if you're under 35. In his book, The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, he reflects upon the racial components of gentrification here in Washington, D.C., and Logan Circle specifically, mm-hmm. which is just a few blocks from here. And what happens in this book is that racial tensions between white newcomers and African-American old-timers escalate. And the main character in the book is an Ethiopian immigrant who owns a convenience store on Georgia Avenue. And he struggles to build cultural bridges between these communities because he becomes very close friends with one of the white newcomers. And his failures or his struggles become part of his alienation. And this is the dominant theme or climax of the story. And so the question is, you know, we all want to believe in multiculturalism and we want to be optimistic about it. But, are there moments of cultural isolation where you're neither here nor there? This character is an immigrant, and that's what I felt like I was getting from the novel, that he's neither here nor there back home in Ethiopia. So tell me about that.
I'm always here nor there. I grew up in Missouri, and my neighborhood was pretty white. And in Nigeria, I'm never going to be Nigerian. My name alone says I'm never going to be American, but I'm an American citizen. And I remember a few months ago, I was talking to this Nigerian, and he's a student, and he just got here from Nigeria. And he just said, "You're saying that because you're an American." I'm just like, it was very acquisitory. Like, I'm like, yeah, I am an American, but, you know, I sometimes feel like I'm invalidated a lot because I am this in between, like the diaspora term is just a very confusing space to be in because there's not really a clear path in influencing policy back home and influencing policy here that is affecting the continent. So just the territory.
Yeah, I agree. I grew up throughout Africa and lived half of my life in Asia. So whenever I go back to Uganda, you know, the automatic assumption is you're not Ugandan. You know, who are you coming from afar? You whatever. You're not like us. So if I was, no, I'm Ugandan. I'm just like you guys. And when I'm over here, I'm seen as African first, maybe Ugandan later, but I'm seen as something different. Back there, I mean, identity is fluid. You can, depending on the situation you're in, one side comes out more than the other. But I would say, especially for people in diaspora, is that you bring a rich experience by being able to experience both cultures, because you can see things that work here, things that work there, and you have a more nuanced view of something. Instead of only holding on to one viewpoint, you have more, and you can bring more to the table. So I think it's an asset. A lot of the times it comes across as something negative because you feel that you don't really belong, but maybe that's a good thing that you don't really belong, because then you have more of a wider
mobility.
Mobility and understanding.
I was going to say, I feel like just like many Africans before myself, I found Africa when I came here. And that was just because living in Ghana, you just know about Ghana or you're a single community. But, you know, when you come here, you are part of a diaspora. You have to, like, you get to learn and meet other people, just learn about them. And that's, I think, that has, to some extent, been the biggest disservice to the youth. back in Africa, because I think that if the youth in Africa knew about the things going on in other places, they knew about, like, you know, the rap, using rap to, you know, kind of like send a political message and things, I think that would encourage youth to be more participatory and then realize that we have the same problems, like, across the continent, and so we need to, like, I'm not saying Africa Unite per se, but, you know, we need to get together and kind of like and tackle these very same issues and start talking about these same issues. But I think that being here for now, it's a really good thing, just like you mentioned. I think that it is interesting because you are neither here nor there, but I think that that's a good thing also, because I think that, you know, our country's borders were drawn arbitrarily, and There is very little. We cling to things like ethnicity or language, and these are not very substantial things that we use to define ourselves. And so I feel like coming here and becoming part of the diaspora is almost a liberating experience, because it's you begin to care about Africa also. I don't think I cared about Africa before I came here, and I guess it's that struggle or clinging onto that is what makes it worth it. It makes you authentically African, I think so.
Yes, I mean, I totally agree. I think, you know, a few things I would say, seeing that as a bridge, you know, because I, for example, did not grow up here. I came for university with my family when I was 17, so, and I've been here for a while now. But so my viewpoint is definitely shaped by, you know, I was born and raised there. So, you know, I have this thing, this dichotomy, which is, you know, yes, I was, but then my formative years, if you will, because it's university, were done here. So, you know, and as you widely pointed, in terms of, I cared about Senegal and the continent, learned about it, but it's also in terms of the educational system, right, French system. So there are certain things I do not necessarily, at least at my school again, do not learn about or know about in terms of other, countries on the continent that I got to learn about and know about when I came here, because of the exposure I got to other cultures, etc. But I think what needs to be done more in our respective countries are being able to facilitate those exchanges as well, in terms of, you know, schools, and in terms of, you know, being able to also tell the people in the country, you know, you are part of a larger continent. Yes, you watch TV, you know, but your views are definitely shaped by what's happening in your own country, so you don't necessarily look outside the box. And I think and that's why I said we are a bridge in a way, because I definitely feel very, strong. I'm strong about making sure that, you know, people know that, you know, as I said, there are other people in other countries, and those experiences can be brought definitely to your country, and then we can only empower each other and strengthen, you know, what's there. True, when you go back home sometimes, you know, you are looked as the other person who comes from outside because you live, you know, in the U.S. or in France or wherever. But one thing that we need to not do as well is being, you know, and I do it, confrontational, or, you know, when you go, you know, people perceiving you as, you know, yes, I know everything, so I'm trying to tell you, and I'm imposing my views on what you think, you know, is. So I think, again, there needs to be dialogue, and there needs to be engagement, and, you know, going back home, there are a lot of things that are going wrong, and you look at them, and you just like, you just move this one thing, it would be okay. I keep on being on cars and yelling, and my cousin is like, you can't yell at people on the street because they are not driving correctly. And I'm like, but they know that they're not supposed to be doing these things. But because I've been out, yes, but, you know, even people that are in also realize this. So it's working and seeing how those things can be changed, and just not being just about the talk, you know, that being an active player, basically. You know, and making sure that, you know, your expertise and what you know can complement the expertise and that's on the ground. Because, you know, to be honest, you know, what people are doing on the ground, they sometimes know more than what you know. And I think it's about, you know, making sure that there is still that, you know, that interaction, and that capitalizing on, you know, what's there and what's here and what you can, because at the end of the day, as I said, it's about making sure that your country, your continent advances, and that, you know, at the end of the day, you can say, okay, I think we are on the right path. Right.
Adele, do you want the last word before we do Q&A, or should you just go straight ahead?
I can say I got here 2 months ago, so
But I mean, I always make this joke to my friend that I came all the way to the U.S. to learn about Africa, because like you, I went to the French system. I never lived in Cameroon. I lived in Chad, Guinea, Mali, but I was going to French schools. So I can tell you 100%, I never learned anything about the history of the country that I was living in. Never, ever, ever. I had one teacher once who organized this, and when I was in Mali, this little visit to Tirailleurs, so like a former soldier. That's the only thing I've done. Never. I know everything about the French history from beginning to end. I know everything about the American, I'm not an expert, but I've learned about it. The American history, everything. So as you all said, it's really when I went out, when I went to France, that I realized that I had to care about Africa more than I used to before. I mean, living in Africa I just assume that we're all from the same economic class. It is true that if we're middle class or something, sometimes we're kind of outside of the reality. We're just this 1%, let's say. And it's really important to come back and try to understand what's going on, really. Mm-hmm. It's really funny. It's really when I came back from my first year in France that I was like, okay, I really don't know anything about this country. I don't know what's going on. I don't know the realities. I don't know what something is like this and what it doesn't work. And I feel really bad. I just wondered what was I doing for 17, 16 years of living in Africa, and what was I doing, really? It's really funny. I mean, the French system, educational system, is very weird. It's just really about learning about France and how great France is. And I'm serious. I was 10 or something like this, and I was watching this TV with my brother, who loves watching documentaries. And then I told him, I remember that. That's one thing that really marked me. I told him, well, how come there were no great warriors in Africa? How come there was nothing? Because that's really what I thought. Everything I learned was about, oh, Alexander the Great and blah, 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 and everything. And even Egypt, the Egyptian civilization, they taught us in a way that it was not really African, you know. It was just something else. Not really Africa. Let's just put it somewhere else. It's not really there. It's not Africa. So, people have to watch out for this. Because a lot of people that I know that I went to school with are now here, and they're just saying, wow, I'm never going back there. It's so bad, and it's going to stay bad, and I'm not going back there. And it's really bad because it's really about the education we received at school. Honestly, what you learn is that there was nothing there. There was really nothing there. We came and we gave you all that. And it's great. And our country is what you should look like, and this is what you look like, and this is bad. And I mean, it's really sad, but I'm happy that I managed to get out of that. I mean, I wasn't thinking that it was bad to be Cameroonian or Malian or anything, but it's a big cultural alienation. But one important thing, though, that I did, being, for example, whenever every time that I go from Mali to Cameroon, I would always become more, I would defend Mali while being in Cameroon and say, well, you know what, in Mali, whenever I do this little, I would go for 2 months, and I say, whenever I come back, there's like a new road that is built. Whenever I come back, there's this new bridge, this new construction going on. And here, every time I come back, it's exactly the same. The road leading to my house is still like not built, and it's been 20 years that it's supposed to be built. But then when I go to Mali, I'm always like, well, you know what, in Cameroon, people go to school. Here, people don't even go to school and everything. So this is to say the differences, and actually you really become more aware of the positive sides and the negative sides of the country once you go out of there, and you see what's good, what's worked there, and what's changing in the country, and what should be, you know, also in changing in your country. So it's a good thing being outside.
Great round of answers. So let's take two questions succinct together and speak loudly for the benefit of the recording. We're going to try to podcast this. Yuma and then Amira.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Yuma Sek, and I just finished my MSc at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And I have two separate questions for the panel. now, one being the role of media. I did not really hear any of you speak of how the media, both in the Western world and in Africa, portrays the African continent in a way that can either be negative or positive. For example, in Senegal, when the little election violence was happening, the Western media portrayed it as another African country is going down the drain. But we put them wrong. So I would like for one of you or all of you to accentuate on the role of media. Number two is more of a comment on social corporate responsibility in the part of businesses. I feel that many businesses today are not, well, they're trying to incorporate social responsibility, but they're not proactively doing it for the businesses that are in Africa right now to say, okay,